is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
Afghanistan, ISIS, the Taliban, Al-Qaeda. Lessons learned from 2021, the second year of the pandemic. I welcome my colleagues, Tom Joslin and Bill Rojo. They are senior fellows at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. They and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, a chronicle, an analysis, what you eventually understand as a timeline of a war in a vast landscape, the Ummah. And I've asked them for their comments about lessons learned in this last year. We begin with the Taliban and Afghanistan, the tragedy of the middle of August, ongoing. This is 18 weeks to my count on a Monday when the U.S. left with the last aircraft and the chaos at the Kabul airport. Bill, I begin with you because your chronicle of the Afghanistan war dates back decades. What have we learned this year about the Taliban and about the people of Afghanistan now under the boot of the Taliban? Good day to you, Bill.
Good day, John, and Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and Happy Holidays to you and all your listeners. Yeah, we learned a lot of lessons, not just about the Taliban and Afghanistan, but about us, about America. And, you know, to me, the biggest takeaway is, and we should have known this years ago, is that we don't have the will to fight long wars. Our political system is not properly set up to deal, particularly today, with how divided we are as a nation. It's bled into foreign policy. It has for at least over a decade now. And this sabotaged efforts to bring stability to both Iraq and Afghanistan and other countries where the U.S. is engaged. Our efforts have been fractured. Our policies have been fractured. But, you know, with the Taliban, what we learned is what we should have known from the very beginning. And that was the Taliban was a religiously motivated, committed jihadist group that had one singular goal. That was to conquer Afghanistan and reimpose its Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan on the Afghan people. It said it from the beginning. U.S. policymakers and generals our so-called experts on Afghanistan all told us that the Taliban was willing to negotiate and join an inclusive government with the former Afghan government and do things like, you know, respect human rights and women's rights and things like that. And the Taliban was having none of that. We learned that the Taliban is adept at political negotiations, whereas the U.S. is horrid at this. Our diplomacy has been what Tom beautifully describes as a servile diplomacy. We gave the Taliban everything they wanted and received nothing in return. And this is why we have an Afghanistan controlled by the Taliban. The Taliban is clever. It's committed. And the U.S., after its horrific withdrawal from Afghanistan, looks weak and feckless. And these problems are going to bleed over. They already are in dealings with Russia and China.
Tom, your lessons learned from Afghanistan and the Taliban in the second year of the pandemic.
You know, John, I think it's, you know, as Bill was discussing it, I kept thinking about how this is really the culmination of so many years of flawed policy, flawed thinking, and assumptions that were made by the people who directed the war in Afghanistan. You know, one of the things I keep coming back to is that, you know, a lot of policymakers, a lot of American leaders or so-called leaders only saw the enemy that they wanted to see in Afghanistan. They didn't want to see the reality. And so, you know, you see some press reporting trying to basically obfuscate what transpired here. You see some accounts basically saying that, well, nobody really saw that the Afghan government was going to crumble so quickly. And, but, you know, this isn't bragging on behalf of Bill or myself or you, John, because we've talked about this for so long. You know, it didn't take much for us to see that it was going to crumble quickly and that the situation was a lot more precarious and a lot more dicey than the policymakers wanted to believe. And I think it's sort of just a continuation of the delusions that we've seen all along. You know, for so many years, people in Washington in particular assumed that Afghanistan was going to turn out a certain way. it did not turn out that way. And yet it did not lead them to question their assumptions. It did not lead them to question all the failures in leadership, all the failures that we've witnessed through the years. And I think that speaks to a bigger problem in our society now in 2021. I think, John, when you look around, you know, you see a lot of popular discontent with America's elite, American leadership. And the reason for that is that my view is that there's never any accountability, that nobody is ever held accountable for their failures, that basically they just move on to the next failure. And we've certainly seen that with Afghanistan. You now have the same people who brought us to failure in Afghanistan, or at least some of the same people at State Department elsewhere who brought us to failed policies around that war. You know, they're advocating for us to basically be even more servile in the face of the Taliban now and to really placate the Taliban even further and give them basically whatever they want. This just can't last. Eventually, there needs to be accountability for failure.
Failure. Bill, that points us immediately to a New York Times report over these last days of the air war, not just in Afghanistan, although that's a major component because it spills into the borderlands with Pakistan, but the air war in extending into Iraq and Syria, at least since 2014, documented. The suggestion is that when the Obama administration switched from ground war to air war in 2009 and afterwards, the Pentagon conducted its air war not without transparency. What do you learn from the few documents we have so far, Bill, about the air war you and Tom and your colleagues have reported on? We had a conversation about this last week because we weren't getting any details of an airstrike in Syria. This seems to tell everyone that that's a policy, not a lack on our part of understanding. The Pentagon has not been clear about its conduct for many years.
Well, John, what I've learned from all of this is absolutely nothing. What these documents tell us is that when you conduct air operations at a high intensity in civilian areas, that civilians will be killed. This should be surprising to absolutely no one. We're not talking about the air campaign, the drone campaign that was targeting Al-Qaeda and the Taliban in Pakistan's tribal areas, where targets were, you know, the strikes were one every week or month, a couple of week at a times, where they were carefully sifted through. And even in those cases where a great effort was made, there's civilian casualties because you're fighting an enemy that fights amongst and lives amongst the civilian population. They're guerrillas. This is natural. In the case of Iraq and Syria, when the U.S. stepped up the fight against the Islamic State after it took over an area the size of Britain, this wasn't a drone campaign. This was an air operation. This was an air campaign with tens of thousands of bombs and missiles being launched at various targets and done it over the course of several years. I would expect there to be thousands of civilian casualties in strikes like this. Instead, what the Obama administration and the Pentagon and everyone else tried to sell us was that they were conducting this safe and bloodless operation that would only kill terrorists and not kill civilians, and that great care was made. Now, some of these, the characterization of some of this, I look at this and I see mistakes, particularly when you're, again, we're not talking about well-planned operations that are being, spent over days and weeks. Some of these are targets of opportunity with limited intelligence. Civilians will be killed. And that's what I saw when reading the New York Times report. I haven't seen the full documents, but, everyone wants a bloodless war. They want no civilians to be killed in air operations. You could have had one of two things. You could have civilians killed and the Islamic State being defeated, and that's what it largely has been. They are underground now and control very little territory in Iraq and Syria. That's what you have. You couldn't, or they could still be in control and not conduct the air operations, because very likely that it was impossible for the Syrian Defense Forces, which is really the Communist Kurdistan Workers or Marxist Kurdistan Workers Party, and Iraqi forces would have had great difficulty retaking these areas without U.S. air support. We were the air arm for the Syrian government, the Kurdish Defense Forces, the Iraqi military, which was backed by the Iranians, in order to defeat the Islamic State And civilians, unfortunately, were going to die in an air operation that was this intense.
Bill Rojo and Tom Justin, they're senior fellows at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We are examining 2021, the second year of the pandemic, and lessons learned. We turn now to Al-Qaeda, ISIS, ISIS, Al-Qaeda. They do tend to blend together, especially when you leave the region of the Afghanistan, Pakistan, and move into the Arab Peninsula, Arabian Peninsula, and then into Africa. When we come back, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Bill Rojo and Tom Jossen of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. We're reviewing what lessons learned from 2021, the second year of the pandemic, with regard to the adversaries in the Ummah, this vast canvas they and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. Tom, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, they can blend together sometimes in geographies when you leave Afghanistan, where Al-Qaeda has been dominant for many decades, and you move into not just the Arabian Peninsula, but Africa, ISIS becomes a term that is used routinely by what appear to be outlaw groups. At this end of the year, can we say that we've learned anything about how ISIS is operating, how Al-Qaeda is operating, and how they either work together or tolerate each other in the same geography?
You know, I think overall, John, they still are very much at odds with one another. You know, ISIS rose as a challenge to basically to Al-Qaeda's authority within the global jihad, and they reject the Taliban's authority in its Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan, which, of course, Al-Qaeda supports that Islamic Emirate and really has a share in that joint venture and share in that government, really, because it's partly their government as well. But I think across the board, the two remain largely at odds. There are areas, as you say, where they converge and they've had some sort of accommodation they've reached over time. But this has still been the greatest sort of rivalry in the history of modern global jihadism, for sure. I could think it's going to continue. You know, one of the things we do is we track a lot of the messaging that's put out by these groups, these organizations, and ISIS in its newsletter on Naba, which came out throughout this year, the second year of the pandemic, they stress the rejection of Al-Qaeda consistently in their messaging. They're still very much organizationally and from a central leadership standpoint, reject Al-Qaeda and attack Al-Qaeda rhetorically all the time. It's very interesting. The two have two different models for waging jihad. ISIS is very much in your face, has very consistent branding, is very much tries to portray itself as one cohesive organization across the board, and in some cases it is. Whereas Al-Qaeda likes to basically enmesh itself in these local conflicts and basically obscure its enemies' views of its organization and what it's doing. And that strategy for Al-Qaeda has largely worked in a lot of areas. I mean, Afghanistan is one of the key areas where Al-Qaeda was busy taking over the country with the Taliban, while the State Department, Defense Department were telling us that Al-Qaeda was barely present in Afghanistan at all. So, it's really two different models for waging jihad going forward. And I think you're going to see in the coming year, they're going to continue to compete. And you'll see how that's going to play out.
In geography, Tom, would you say that one or the other Al-Qaeda, ISIS has an advantage in Africa? Because over these last months, you know, the Long War Journal has been reporting increasingly of what appears to be ISIS conduct or ISIS link conduct in Africa. Is that a fresh wave where Al-Qaeda is no longer dominant, or is it too early to tell?
I think in different areas I think across Africa, I would give the edge to Al-Qaeda because you look at Shabab in East Africa, they dominate the ISIS presence there. ISIS is not nearly as strong in East Africa as Al-Qaeda's arm is. In West Africa, it's a little bit more of a mixed story. ISIS is definitely closer to being a pure competitor, really, to the Al-Qaeda group or organization there, which is known as the Group for Support of Islam and Muslims, which sounds charitable and benign, but isn't. They're more evenly matched, I would say, there in West Africa. But still, I think in the long run, I would still give Al-Qaeda the edge. I think, again, you know, when it comes to Africa, it's the same situation as elsewhere, that, you know, the U.S. often gets confused by very simple tactics by Al-Qaeda. If Al-Qaeda doesn't announce itself on a daily basis in any of these different geographies, then the prevailing assumption or prevailing paradigm in U.S. policy circles is to assume that they're not there. And so this has led to a lot of confusion across Africa. And this is one of the reasons why, John, I'm deeply skeptical going forward of any deeper U.S. military involvement in Africa. I think we should be very careful here. I think the U.S. got Afghanistan very wrong. It's gotten other theaters very wrong. We have to be very careful going forward in Africa about what the U.S. actually does.
Bill, I come to you about al-Qaeda's successes or unknowns in 2021. Tom points to a major success, which is to conduct Afghanistan as if it wasn't present. What I'm keen on is al-Qaeda training camps. Those were the fertile ground for the original attack on the West 20 years ago. Do you have or is there under... way an assessment of al-Qaeda training camps at CENTCOM, at the Pentagon, at the State Department? Is that a conversation that is going on, Bill, or has it been left to the dustbin?
That conversation has largely been left to the dustbin. I mean, you had General McKenzie, the commander of CENTCOM, say the other day that the U.S. intelligence view into Afghanistan is now 1-2% of what it used to be when the U.S. was present in the country. So what we have there is Afghanistan going dark. What we do know is al-Qaeda, while the U.S. was present in Afghanistan, ran numerous, or should I say multiple, training camps in the country. Some of these were raided by the U.S., and it's not just al-Qaeda. It's groups like Harkat al-Mujahideen, movement of the Taliban in Pakistan, Lashkar-e-Taiba, all these al-Qaeda allied groups, all the groups in the sphere. They were operating these camps in the past while the U.S. was in country. There is no reason to believe that this has abated. We're starting to see reports of foreign recruits flowing into Afghanistan. McKenzie somewhat downplayed this, but did say he's seeing a trickle. But I'm seeing some press reports now saying that this is a little bit more significant. But again, we don't really know because the Taliban controls the country. There's no free Afghan press. Afghanistan has become a black hole. And this is the danger of a Taliban controlled Afghanistan. We just don't know what's happening there. But what we do know is the Taliban al-Qaeda alliance is as strong as ever. Al-Qaeda, as Tom noted, played a key role in the Taliban's success, particularly in areas in the north and in the east and elsewhere in Afghanistan. But they've been allied, and I would expect there to be camps operating there to this day. Now, the Taliban and al-Qaeda will keep this on the down low because it's in both of their interests to do so.
Tom, your final thoughts this year, at the end of the year, was this a victory year for al-Qaeda? Do you see that? Do they talk in that fashion, or are they keeping quiet on their success?
Al-Qaeda very much discusses this in terms of their own victory. And I think it speaks to the great confusion on the American side that the U.S. doesn't even really understand the degree to which it lost the war in Afghanistan. And I think there's understandably, a lot of popular discontent with what we witnessed over the last 20 years. And all we could say is that, we can provide you additional examples of why there should be discontent, because al-Qaeda won the longest war in America's history.
I thank Tom Joslin and Bill Rojo. Here at the end of 2021, we will begin again in the third year of the pandemic to assess, thanks to the very careful reporting of they and their colleagues at the Long War Journal. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.